Port Arthur, The Dissenting Narrative, Podcast, Part 1. My name is Arthur Marcel. I'm a retired teacher. In this talk, I'm going to review the case for Martin Bryant not being the Port Arthur shooter. To reduce the size of this podcast, I will be omitting references. However, these, including all details of witness statements, can be found in the transcript. To begin with, a word about black swans. Celebrated sleuth Sherlock Holmes' most famous quote went something like, "Firstly, Watson, we eliminate the impossible, and then we are left with a range of options, one of which, no matter how seemingly improbable, will be the truth." Holmes' creator, author Arthur Conan Doyle, appears to have gotten it wrong when he described his most famous character as a master of deduction. The fictional detective's methods are clearly inductive. Induction is a bottom-up process, starting with facts derived from empirical observation and interview. These facts are then used to form working hypotheses, which eventually lead to logically probable explanations. Deduction is the very reverse of induction, a top-down process starting with general principles and beliefs, which are used to explain specific situations. Deduction, or rather deductive reasoning, works very well in axiomatic environments. So long as the premises are true and the methods syllogistically valid, the answers are always correct. If initial premises are wrong, however, it is a case of garbage in, garbage out. Induction, on the other hand, only assigns degrees of probability based on objective evaluation of evidence and can never say what is absolutely true. It can, however, rule out what is not true with a single example, the legendary black swan. There have been more than 5 independent, privately funded investigations into the Port Arthur massacre. These investigations have produced a more or less consensual, alternative narrative very different to the official one. More than 20 separate evidence-based arguments have been put forward in support of this dissenting narrative, with at least 2 of these being black swan type arguments, in that they completely and without doubt prove the official narrative to be false. Most Australians are naively accepting of the official narrative without caring to even know the details of it. For those who engage with the dissenting story, however, the experience is deeply troubling. Let us now look at the official narrative. It is alleged that Martin Bryant left his new townhome shortly before 10 a.m. on the 28th of April 1996, after having spent the night and the previous 3 nights with his girlfriend Petra Wilmot. He drove his yellow Volvo 240 GL sedan with surfboard on top to Seascape Cottage, a bed and breakfast about 3.4 kilometres north of the entrance to the Port Arthur historic site. He had 2 rifles with him, one being an AR-15, a high-velocity semi-automatic rifle, American design, original company Armalite but now Colt, calibre 223 Remington, otherwise known as 5.56 NATO, the civilian version of the widely used M16. And the other rifle, an SLR, a high-velocity semi-automatic military rifle, Belgian design, company Fabrique Nationale, designation FNFAL, but also manufactured by Lithgow Arms for the Australian military forces in the 60s and 70s, designation L1A1, calibre 7.62mm NATO, otherwise known as 308 Winchester. As well, he had a Daewoo 12-gauge automatic shotgun and 2 pairs of Smith & Wesson handcuffs. Upon arrival, he used the AR-15 to shoot dead the owners of Seascape, David and Sally Martin, people he was long acquainted with and against whom he is purported to have held some kind of grudge. The 2 shots were heard by a person from the neighbouring property after 10 a.m. and definitely prior to 11 a.m. It is alleged that Bryant then drove to the Port Arthur historic site, entering through the toll booth to park his car down near the waterfront opposite the Broad Arrow Cafe. He took his newly purchased blue print sports bag containing the AR-15 and a video camera from the boot and carried them into the cafe. He put the bag and the camera on a table and bought a meal and a drink, which he consumed outside on the veranda. When finished eating, he went back inside, opened the bag, took out the rifle, and proceeded to shoot dead 10 people and seriously wound another 10 in just under 30 seconds. He then moved to the adjacent gift shop where he killed another 8 people and wounded 2. Total elapsed time at this stage was 90 to 120 seconds. He had fired 29 shots from a 30-round magazine and was heard changing magazines as he exited the cafe. Bryant left his blueprint sports bag on the table he had been using, along with his video camera. He then carried the rifle to the bus parking area where he shot more people, bringing the total casualties to 26 dead, including the Martins, and 18 wounded. At this crime site, in addition to the AR-15, he also used the SLR, which he took from the boot of the Volvo. He then drove slowly along Jetty Road towards the toll booth. On the way, he stopped to kill Mrs. Mikak and her 2 young daughters with the AR-15. At the toll booth, he shot dead 4 people who had just arrived in a gold-coloured BMW. Total now 33 dead, including the Martins, and 19 wounded. He then transferred his 2 rifles to the BMW, leaving the shotgun in the Volvo, and drove the BMW a little further on to the Port Arthur service station. There he kidnapped Glenn Pierce at gunpoint, forcing him into the boot of the BMW, and then shot Pierce's girlfriend through the door of their Toyota car. After that, he drove up the highway to Seascape in the BMW, where he bogged the car in soft ground behind the house. Then he ran back to the roadway to shoot at oncoming cars. Several people were wounded, but all survived. After shooting at 5 cars, he ran back to the house, removing Glenn Pierce from the car boot at gunpoint and taking him inside to secure him to heavy furniture with the 2 sets of Smith & Wesson handcuffs. The so-called Seascape siege then began. The BMW was soon seen to be burning. The siege lasted till the next morning when Bryant allegedly set fire to the house and eventually emerged with third-degree burns to his back. He was arrested. Total number of dead was 35, all shot. Total number of wounded was 23, 24 if you include Bryant, and there were 7 crime scenes in all. In the ruins of Seascape, several firearms or parts of firearms were found, the most notable being a badly damaged AR-15 and a badly damaged SLR, allegedly the Port Arthur Historic Site murder weapons. Let us now look at the dissenting narrative, but before doing that, I would like to acknowledge, in chronological order, the investigative work of authors such as Noel MacDonald, A Presentation on the Port Arthur Incident, Prelude to a Royal Commission, 2001. Andrew McGregor, Deceit and Terrorism, Port Arthur, 2001 to 2004. Wendy Skerr, My Experiences at Port Arthur in Deceit and Terrorism, Port Arthur, Andrew McGregor, 2001 to 2004. Stuart Beattie, A Gunsmith's Notebook on Port Arthur, 6th edition, May 2006. Carl Vernerhoff, A Critical Study of the Port Arthur Massacre, 2006. Ian McNiven, Port Arthur Cover-Up, 2009. Carlene Bryant, My Story, 2010. Keith Allen Noble, Mass Murder, Official Killing in Tasmania, Australia, 2013. And the follow-up to that book, Official Terror in Tasmania, Australia, 2019. I would also acknowledge other authors on internet sites such as Gumshoe News and IINet Port Arthur Massacre Index, as well as Adam Crabb's excellent Kras Files website. So to begin the dissenting narrative, there were significant circumstantial precursors to the Port Arthur story. For example, a 22-body mortuary van was purchased some months before the massacre by the Tasmanian government and sold not long after. A media conference was also organised for that day in Hobart with large numbers, about 700, of visiting Australian and international journalists on hand to cover the story. As well, a medical conference was held for trauma doctors from around the country and overseas on the same day in Hobart. Another conference for senior Port Arthur Historic Site Management took them off-site for the day, for the first time ever. And a tour group of 80-plus North American retirees was booked in for a trip on the Port Arthur Historic Site ferry to the Isle of the Dead for 1:30 p.m. that day. Finally, it is highly significant that the drafting of the National Firearms Agreement had been completed only months prior. The states were required to relinquish their authority to the federal government, but the Queensland and Tasmanian governments were refusing to do this. There is also a report of a special embalming box being ordered. Two specially designed embalming machines were sent to Hobart. Quote, "One firm in particular, Nelson Brothers, 7 Droop Street, Footscray, Victoria, 3011, was organised for an embalming machine box and a special large equipment case to be manufactured ready for the incident. These two containers were the envy of all embalmers and worked extremely well," was recorded. End of quote. Now that is from Stephen Parry, Port Arthur Massacre 1996, Australian Funeral Directors Association National Embalming Team. Detailed report, Port Arthur Seminar Papers, 1997, page 112. Stephen Parry went on to be the President of the Australian Senate, by the way. Now, it might be asked, why would there be such openly obvious preparation for a massacre? However, it should be remembered that in 1996, the internet was in its infancy. Its disruptive potential in terms of the dissemination of dissenting information had been neither realised nor tested. In the absence of the internet, the confidence displayed was indeed justified, because ultimately it has only been through means of the internet that such dissenting information has come to light and reached the audience it has. The conventional mass media certainly has not contributed one iota to the dissenting story, not only unquestioningly pushing the official line, but in many cases leading the fray like a pack of mindless foxhounds. It is true that Martin Bryant had an interest in firearms, but he said it was more a pleasure derived from their ownership than their use. For an Australian male of his age, especially one who grew up in a country area, this situation is not unusual. About 7 years before the Port Arthur shootings, he bought an AR-10 semi-automatic rifle, the original Armalite 7.62 NATO caliber design, from which the smaller AR-15 was later modelled. He also admitted to buying an AR-15 5 months before the shootings. As well, he admitted to purchasing a Daewoo 12-gauge automatic shotgun about 4 months before the shootings. He said he had used the three firearms very rarely. In fact, he said he had never fired the shotgun at all, being a little afraid of its power, meaning, supposedly, its recoil. Of the three guns identified in the official narrative as being involved in the Port Arthur shootings, only the shotgun possibly belonged to Bryant. The AR-15 was not his. It was later identified as a weapon surrendered during a Victoria Police amnesty several years before. There was no suggestion in the official narrative that an AR-10 was used at the historic site, and Bryant's AR-10 was actually in a gun shop for repairs at the time. Tasmania Police tried to coerce the gun shop proprietor Terry Hill into lying about this, but he refused, and subsequently had his dealer's license revoked. As for the SLR, Bryant denied ever having seen it before. As well, he freely admitted that he possessed neither a driver's license nor a gun license. Some time before the shootings, Bryant was befriended by a person he referred to as Tiger. Bryant was not overly fond of this person. In fact, he behaved as if he was afraid of him. Both Bryant's mother and girlfriend were of the opinion that contact with Tiger caused Bryant to become anxious. It has been suggested in various publications that a Tasmania Police Special Operations Group officer, Michael Charles Dyson, may have been the man Bryant knew as Tiger, but there is no evidence for this. That Sunday morning, Petra Wilmot left the new townhouse before Bryant. She was going to spend the Sunday with her parents, as was her usual practice. She later said Bryant was happy and relaxed when they parted. He told her he intended to go surfing at Roaring Beach on the Tasman Peninsula south of the Port Arthur historic site. This narrative asserts that Martin Bryant was preordained to take the blame for the Port Arthur shootings. For conspirators to be sure that Bryant would finish the day inside Seascape Cottage during the siege, his movements from the time he left the new townhouse therefore not only needed to be predetermined but also monitored and controlled. So a central assertion of this narrative is that a key conspirator, possibly the man he knew as Tiger, arranged or suggested the plan to go to Roaring Beach that morning, and that somewhere along his journey Bryant was intercepted and taken to, or told to go to, Seascape Cottage. Bryant's movements during the day are not easy to verify. He claimed he departed the new townhouse later than officially stated, in fact not until 11 a.m. Witnesses reported seeing him at four locations en route that morning, where he shopped, got petrol and had a coffee. However, only one of these sightings, a coffee stop at Fawcett, even though Bryant later incorrectly recalled having had the coffee at nearby Sorrel, was a credible identification of Bryant. The timing of this sighting is sufficient, though, to make it impossible for Bryant to have been at Seascape before 11 a.m. when David Martin was murdered. The time of this sighting also fits perfectly with Bryant having left home at 11 a.m. The times of the other three sightings do not fit at all with the timing of this credible sighting of Bryant. The other three sightings are thought to have been of the eventual Port Arthur historic site gunman, Broad Arrow Cafe gunman at least, because there may have been more than one gunman that day, who travelled the route earlier than Bryant, about an hour earlier, and was leaving a trail of deception to implicate him. One shop person actually remembered Bryant and supposedly his car from a previous trip, and said, quote, when he came in on the Sunday to buy the lighter, he had lost weight and his hair was considerably longer. He used to have short hair. He just came in, bought the lighter and left. It was as though I was a total stranger to him, which I wasn't, end of quote. I might add here that Bryant did not smoke tobacco or other drugs. At another sighting, Bryant's impersonator actually carried a large bag, presumably the blueprint sports bag that was later to become an important element in the official narrative, into a shop simply for it to be seen in his possession. The shooter was driving a yellow Volvo 240 sedan, same model as Bryant's, with at least one, possibly two, surfboards on top. This is where the narrative becomes difficult to relate with certainty. Bryant claimed he turned off the Arthur Highway at Tirana and took the northern section of the Nabina Road to Roaring Beach. This route puts the beach at about 1.5 hours drive from Newtown, so counting the coffee shop at Fawcett, Bryant could not have arrived at the beach much before 12:40 p.m. if he had left his house at 11 a.m. He also said the beach was about 5 minutes' walk from the car park and that he surfed for 20 minutes. He then said he got dressed and headed back to Nabina, where he had another coffee and a toasted sandwich. He also admitted to having had his AR-15 rifle and his Daewoo shotgun with him in the car. He actually kept his guns in the car most of the time. He said he stopped on the way at a place called Merdunna, where he had used the guns on targets before. He said he had 8 or 9 cartridges for the AR-15 and fired 2, and only 2 of them, at a target but didn't use the shotgun. Remember, he claimed he had never fired it. So that must have taken at least another 20 minutes or so. Bryant said that after eating his meal at Nabina, he drove along the southern section of the Nabina Road past the Port Arthur Historic Site turnoff towards Seascape, which is about a 20-minute drive. 3 kilometres from the Port Arthur historic site on Palmer's Lookout Road, Roger Roy Maxwell Lana owned a property. On the night of the siege, quite amazing in itself, he testified that at about 1:05 p.m. that afternoon, Sunday 28th of April, he was leaving his premises when he encountered Bryant coming along the road. He said that Bryant told him, quote, he was down here surfing, end of quote. They talked for a few minutes, so it is unlikely that Bryant left Lana before 1:15 p.m. the time the actual shooter was driving through the Port Arthur Historic Site toll booth. The reported timing of this encounter, however, is problematic. How could Bryant have been there at that time and still have had his swim at Roaring Beach and his coffee and sandwich at Nobina, not to mention his shooting practice, if he had left his house at 11 a.m? What is even more problematic is that Bryant claimed this meeting with Lana never occurred. At the police interview, he said he had not seen the man for 10 years. Now, why would he lie? He was being handed the perfect alibi. In fact, Bryant comes across as completely truthful during his police interviews. He might have been talking nonsense, but he appeared to have truly believed it. The two detectives could not break his story. The Port Arthur Historic Site shooter, that is, the man driving the look-alike yellow Volvo seen en route by 3 witnesses, arrived at Seascape about mid-morning. It is highly likely he was the one who shot David Martin dead before 11 a.m, both the Martins at this stage having been bound and gagged by a co-conspirator. In his book, A Presentation on the Port Arthur Incident, 2001, page 68, Noel MacDonald writes, quote, what we do know for sure is that Mr. David Martin was killed with 2 gunshots, and that he had been gagged, and that Mrs. Sally or Nolene Martin had been bludgeoned with 5 blows to the head, resulting in a fractured skull. We also know that there were shots heard in the area around the possible or suggested time of murder, as with most times expressed in the court document, they are approximate only. For the sake of a little detective work, many of the facts pertaining to what actually did and did not occur on that morning should have been clearly evident. There is no mistaking the reality that the authorities, the prosecution and the defence counsels all have turned a blind eye to the obvious, and even worse is the fact that the DPP has distorted and ignored what has been recounted by eyewitnesses. Equally disturbing is the omission of facts. End of quote. Author Stuart K. Beattie, in his work A Gunsmith's Notebook on Port Arthur, presents evidence to show that the guns about to be used at the Port Arthur historic site were an AR-15, similar to the one owned by Bryant and carried in his car that day, but which has since vanished, and an AR-10, similar to the rifle owned by Bryant that was at that time in the custody of Hobart gun shop proprietor Terry Hill, and a Daewoo automatic shotgun that might have been the one owned by Bryant and carried in his car that day, but which wouldn't have been if Bryant hadn't arrived at Seascape before the shooter left. There was no SLR 7.62mm rifle taken to or used at Port Arthur that day. The broken one found in the Seascape ruins was placed there after the fire by persons unknown, after it was belatedly realised that Bryant's 7.62mm gun was in Hill's gun shop for repairs. This throwdown rifle was built to metric specifications, a European model, serial number prefixed by the letter G, and would possibly not have accepted the Australian-made Imperial specification magazines that were later allegedly found in the boot of Bryant's Volvo. When shown the rifle at the police interview, Bryant said he had never seen it before. Moreover, he did not even recognise its type, the workhorse of the Australian military forces for 30 years, which shows just what little knowledge of firearms he had. Before departing for the Port Arthur historic site on his deadly mission, the shooter test-fired both assault rifles. Quote, a series of rapidly fired shots, end of quote, coming from the direction of Seascape, was heard between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. by an experienced shooter neighbour living about 500 to 600 metres away, who identified the shots as similar to ones heard later in the day coming from the direction of the historic site. It is thought that this gunfire came after the two shots reported by Seascape's immediate neighbour, and because he had at that stage left the property, he did not hear them. The Broad Arrow Cafe shooter was a male in his late teens or early 20s with a marred complexion, wearing a long, brownish, full-sleeved coat. He had straightish blonde hair below shoulder length, possibly a wig. This shooter has been identified as one of two possible men, both probably now dead. Before leaving Seascape, it seems he contaminated a knife by plunging it into or wiping it on the dead body of David Martin. The official narrative has this knife belonging to Martin Bryant. It was left inside the Blueprint sports bag on the table the shooter used inside the Broad Arrow Cafe, the intent being to link Bryant with the murder of the Martins. The shooter then put the blue bag into a larger black bag along with the two rifles and the shotgun, and he placed the black bag, containing everything, into the boot of the Volvo he had driven that morning. The blue bag was not long enough to carry the weapons by itself. There appears to be no other reason for including the blue bag other than to implicate Bryant. The distance between Seascape Cottage and the Port Arthur Historic Site toll booth is 3.4 kilometres. However, only a short distance from Seascape, the shooter stopped his car behind a van that was parked on the side of the road. Two women were enjoying the view. They also had a problem with their motor, which wouldn't start. The shooter identified the cause of the problem immediately upon inspection of the engine compartment. He reconnected a loose wire and the motor started at once. This episode indicates the shooter had mechanical expertise, unlike Bryant, who was well known for a total lack of practical abilities. The shooter then asked them if they had anything to sell, meaning that he wanted to buy marijuana. They supplied him with, quote, a small satchel, end of quote, and asked for $50 in return, which he happily paid with the one note. The woman who actually did the deal described him as, quote, having an odour about him which was quite strong. It was a musty type of smell, end of quote, which could have been an indication of recent drug ingestion. Quote, I can describe this man as having long, bleached, blonde hair. He appeared to me to be about 19 to 20 years of age, end of quote. Bryant was 28 years old at the time and had naturally blonde, wavy hair, and he had never been known to use marijuana or any other illicit drug. At the Port Arthur Historic Site, the shooter paid at the toll booth and then drove to the waterfront, even though told to park in the main parking area. He became aware that the ferry had left at 1 p.m, half an hour earlier than scheduled, because of a surprise change in the tour timetable. This was a major problem. The local police had ostensibly at this stage been decoyed to the other side of the Tasman Peninsula, and the shooting had to start at 1:30 p.m. So somehow, either by a Plan B pre-arrangement or because the shooter was in radio contact with his controller, the target was changed to the cafe directly opposite the ferry terminal. The shooter took the heavily loaded black bag from the Volvo, as well as Bryant's video camera, slinging both over his shoulder, and walked into the cafe. Several people remember the shooter entering the cafe. Indeed, he seemed to go out of his way to bump into people and be noticed. When he was sitting on the deck outside, he was seen to be muttering to himself and looking anxiously towards the car park. Perhaps he was talking on his two-way radio, having earphones concealed under his long wig. Perhaps he was waiting for Bryant's Volvo to arrive on site, this being the signal for the shooting to begin. The most common element of description for the Broad Arrow Cafe gunman that day was his hair. Martin Bryant had only recently begun to grow his hair longer than normal. The photo that was stolen from his home on the night of the shootings and which appeared illegally on the front page of the Hobart Mercury the following Tuesday, April 30th, 1996, showed him with his hair as long as it ever had been. As already said, it was a natural blonde colour, very wavy, and while quite long, it was above the shoulders. Witnesses described the hair of the Broad Arrow Cafe gunman variously as bedraggled, bleached, straight, flowing in the breeze, flowing across his chest, but never as wavy. More than 19 witnesses described the gunman's hair as shoulder length or below shoulder length, 7 witnesses saying below shoulder length. The shootings took place more or less as per the official narrative, but there were differences. Firstly, the shooter was in the cafe for 5 to 7 minutes after the first shot and more deliberate in choosing victims. He also fired many more rounds than the 29 stated in the official narrative. He changed magazines on the AR-15 in the cafe during the shooting as well as when leaving. Rounds were fired from all 3 weapons, mostly from the AR-15, but about 4 from the AR-10, spent cases being later seen on the floor, and 1 round from the gun, pellets hitting Dennis Olsen in the face, chest, neck and arm, and being positively identified as a shotgun wound by Broad Arrow Cafe first responder and trained paramedic Wendy Skerr. The shooter shot from waist high, holding his weapon about 100 millimetres above the right hip. This is a significant point, as during a videoed police interview, Bryant was shown to have held a rifle left-handedly. It is common for otherwise right-handed individuals to shoot rifles left-handedly if their master eye is their left one, and this may well have been the case. This may well be the case with Bryant. The shooter took shoulder aim at some people on the opposite side of the room, but most shots were at very close range. A malfunctioning fire door at the back of the gift shop turned out to be a death trap for 7 people, 5 who tried to open it and 2 who knew it didn't work and unsuccessfully hid behind the counter. Researchers are of the opinion that there were agent accomplices of the shooter in the cafe who were surprised by the change of venue. Anthony Nightingale, for instance, stood and shouted at the shooter, "No, no, not here," and was shot dead for his trouble. Nightingale was just one of many suspect people at the Port Arthur historic site that day, whose main job was not so much to facilitate the shooting, but mostly to sterilise the site immediately after the shooting. The 4 people in the BMW appear to have been definitely involved as well, 2 of them joining the gunman at one stage in the Volvo for discussions that eventually led to argument and then to their deaths. These people were apparently delivering a fresh car to the gunman so that the yellow Volvo could be left behind to incriminate Bryant. Bryant specifically denied having entered the Port Arthur historic site at all that day. He claimed he couldn't afford the entry fee. Bryant's inheritance was strictly controlled by his guardian, the public trustee, and he was overspent. He said he had not been into the historic site during the preceding 6 or 7 years due to the fact that the entry fee had risen so much. He did say, however, that he called in at Seascape on his way back home from Roaring Beach. Whatever the time it was that he got there, he claimed that when he knocked on the door, no one answered. So he assumed no one was at home and continued on his way. He also said he had not seen the Martins since 1991. There was a credible sighting of a yellow Volvo with surfboard on top turning into the entrance to Seascape at, quote, about 12 p.m, end of quote. The Volvo was travelling northwards, away from the Port Arthur historic site turnoff, which fits. The time, however, does not fit with Bryant's stated timetable. Actually, the witness claimed he had seen the same car going in the other direction about 20 or so minutes before. There may also have been a third yellow Volvo 240 sedan in the vicinity of the Port Arthur historic site that day, one that may have been involved in the facilitation of the massacre. This third Volvo was seen to be driven by 2 women. Bryant made some really bizarre statements at his interview. So bizarre, in fact, that perhaps his removal to Seascape that day involved some kind of surreptitiously administered psychotic drug. It has also been suggested that while in custody, he experienced psychiatric or hypnotic intervention that implanted false and incriminating recollections. Remember, also, that in terms of the dissenting narrative, Bryant was not supposed to have survived the seascape fire and at the time of the interview had been in solitary confinement for over 2 months. He said he stopped a gold BMW at gunpoint at the turnoff to Fortescue Bay Road, that's further north on the Arthur Highway than Seascape, and ordered the driver to get into the boot of the BMW. He said he also asked a woman who, with her young child, was a passenger in the BMW, to get into his Volvo. He then sped off in the BMW back towards Seascape, leaving the Volvo behind. At Seascape, the BMW somehow caught fire. Bryant couldn't remember starting the fire, but admitted that he might have, and he believed the fellow in the boot was incinerated. Bryant was of the opinion that he himself must have also been in the BMW at the time it caught fire, and this was how he got burnt. But he also said he was on the other side of the house knocking on the back door when the BMW burst into flame. The fact that Bryant believed he had commandeered a gold BMW and locked its driver into the boot to be burnt alive is just too coincidental. Either Bryant did indeed hijack the gold BMW from the Port Arthur historic site toll booth, or he had been psychiatrically tampered with in a manner to implant false memories. Effective techniques for the implantation of false memory have been known since the early 90s. Moreover, the corroborative testimony of at least three toll booth witnesses strongly suggests the latter scenario, Bryant being implanted with false memories, is the correct one. The following excerpt is from Mass Murder, Official Killing in Tasmania, Australia by Keith Noble, 2013, page 552. And describes the manner in which the gunman acquired the gold BMW. The gunman, driving some yellow Volvo, had a clear road to go by the toll booth. There was nothing blocking his exit. But he stopped. Why he did is not known. Whether it was pre-planned that he stop, or whether he had received instructions en route to stop, or whether someone from that gold-coloured BMW flagged him down, or... Regardless, the gunman stopped at the toll booth. The following is from the witness statement of Frida Chiok. Quote, "As we were travelling towards the toll gate, I could see two cars ahead and presumed one was going in and the other was coming out. As we approached the toll booth, I saw that one of these cars was a gold-coloured BMW in our lane, facing us and blocking our path. It wasn't until we almost reached the tollgate area that I saw the BMW was parked in our entrance lane. I also saw a yellow-coloured Volvo sedan, which I noticed had a surfboard on top, parked on the road ahead of us but in the correct exit lane, but further back from the BMW. I would estimate that there was less than a car's length between Deborah's car, the car we were in, and the BMW when we came to a halt." End of quote. Noble continues, "If there are any other witness statements which describe the time before this, this editor has not seen them. Again, why the gunman stopped is not something the DPP has reported. Another confounding fact is that the witness, Frida Chiok, and also her son, Nicholas Emmanuel Chiok, said that when they arrived and stopped at the toll booth, two people were seated inside the yellow Volvo, conversing, presumably, with the gunman. And as has been stated several times in this book, no person gets inside a vehicle with a gunman whose weapon is visible on the back seat. Whoever these people were in the Volvo, they must have known the gunman personally or had knowledge about his mass murder plan. The gunman did not stop at the toll booth because he liked the fancy BMW. He did not skid to a halt and shoot the people who arrived in that BMW. No, he stayed in the Volvo he was driving, and it seems that two people got out of the BMW and went and sat with him inside his yellow car." The DPP does not want people to know this because it just ruins the official narrative about a lone nut gunman driving all over the place, killing people here and there and inside the BMW. But it is not the truth. It seems people who arrived in that BMW knew the gunman and went to him. And here it is extremely important to note, those people did not know Martin Bryant and he did not know them. There was no misunderstanding. Noble continues, from everything this editor has studied, those two people who got into the yellow Volvo with the gunman were Helene Saltzman, she sat on the front passenger seat, and Robert Saltzman, he sat on the rear seat behind the driver. He could have felt the warm barrel of the rifle beside him. The two Saltzmans were from Ocean Shores, New South Wales, and seated in the front passenger seat of her BMW, Mary Rose Nixon waited. What was she thinking? What did she think was going to happen? How could this woman, who had her own family, her own children, have been involved in this insanity? Did the two Saltzmans pressure her? Threaten her? The man driving her BMW was Russell Pollard from Brunswick Heads. He was a friend of Mary Rose. She probably addressed him by the familiar name Jim. Those who knew him did. Surely he would have driven away if Mary Rose had said, "Let's get out of here, Jim." But it seems as if she wanted to stay. Did her husband know this side of his wife? Did their children know? What the hell was going on? Don't waste your time looking in official documents. There's nothing about this. Just lies, unproved assertions, and false statements to nail innocent Martin Bryant. Noble continues, but now it was time. Whatever was said to or with the gunman did not endear the two Saltzmans to him, and when Robert Saltzman alighted from that yellow Volvo, thinking no one knows what, he stepped off the land of the living. He did breathe a few more times, but his last gasp was just a few moments away. This is what Nicholas Emmanuel Chiok wrote in his witness statement. Quote, there was a bit more talking, about 10 seconds, between the blonde-haired male and the older man, and then the blonde-haired male lifted up the gun and pointed it at the chest of the older man, and something was said, and then I heard a blast, and the older man's chest just seemed to cave in, and he fell to the ground and didn't move. End of quote. Then it got a lot worse, with the witnesses just metres away and the gunman with his hair, quote, long below his shoulders, end of quote, and oblivious to who was watching, turned to face Russell Pollard. Had Pollard lost his senses? He saw his friend Robert Saltzman get a bullet right into his chest, and given the power of the assault rifle, that bullet would have gone right through Saltzman. If Mary Rose Nixon said a cautious word to Pollard, we will never know. One person who knew Pollard personally told this editor he was no fool. So what was going on that made Pollard think he could get the upper hand? The DPP does not know. The only thing certain then was that the 308 round in the breech was ready for Jim, and the person who fired that round was definitely not Martin Bryant. This is what Frieda Chiok saw. Quote, I then saw the man get out of the driver's seat of the BMW and walk around the front of his car and go in the direction of the blonde-haired man. As the man from the BMW was walking towards him, the blonde-haired man then shot this man. Both these men were shot in the area of their chests. Definitely the man from the BMW, was shot in the chest because as he laid on the ground, I saw a dark patch in the area of his chest. End of quote. And what did the son of Frieda Chiok witness? Quote, the blonde-haired male was half turned to us when he shot the second man. I think he shot the second man in the chest area. When the blonde-haired male shot both men, he was very close to them. I would say the gun was only inches away from the chest of the second man when he shot him, and the gun was right up to the first man's chest when he shot him. End of quote. Noble continues. Readers might think that the two mentioned eyewitnesses, being mother and son, could have influenced each other. Well, it seems not. Here is what the driver of the vehicle they were in said in her witness statement. Quote, he shot the person he had been arguing with. The bullet appeared to go through this person's chest and out his back. I heard another two shots. I looked again, and the older man from the BMW was on the ground along with another woman. This woman was on the road between the gunman's car and the BMW. I'm not sure where she came from. She was wearing a pink, blue and white knitted jumper. I think the gunman, dragged her out of his car, the yellow Volvo, but I'm not sure. End of quote. So from three eyewitnesses who were just a few metres away with an unobstructed view of this mini-massacre, it is reasonable to conclude the following, says Noble. 1. The gunman was in a yellow Volvo. 2. A man and a woman were inside that Volvo with the gunman. 3. The man, believed to be Robert Salzman, got out of the Volvo, followed by the gunman. 4. The gunman took his rifle from the back of the Volvo and shot Salzman point-blank through the chest. 5. A second man, believed to be Russell Jim Pollard, got out of the BMW and walked to the gunman. 6. The gunman shot Pollard point-blank through the chest. 7. The gunman then dragged the woman from the Volvo and shot her. 8. Then the gunman either dragged the woman from the BMW and shot her, or shot her in the BMW before dragging her out. Noble continues. This killing at the fourth crime scene clearly confirms the gunman was a professional killer, probably a psychopath with no conscience. This is not killing you learn how to do and how to remain in absolute control throughout by shooting at a cardboard target in the bush, which is all Martin Bright ever did. This killing at the toll booth was point-blank killing, looking people right in their eyes as their chests were blown inside out. No qualms about murdering women. Drag 'em out and blow the bitches. When Martin heard about the shooting at Port Arthur, he asked if anyone was hurt. It was not some clever reply. Martin was not clever. He doesn't have the brains to be clever. Just as he didn't have the mind and the will to methodically murder four adults at the historic site Tollbooth, just after murdering three, two of whom were children, down along Jetty Road, and all that just after murdering 24 and wounding 23 at and near the Broad Arrow Cafe. That is the end of that long quote from Alan Noble's book. As can be seen, the manner in which the gunman acquired the gold BMW is particularly damning for the official narrative. In fact, we are looking here at a black swan moment for the prosecution's case against Martin Bryant. The official story is certainly undermined in terms of the lone nut with a gun idea. The Salzmans knew the gunman, were not afraid of him, negotiated with him, and had safe opportunity to completely disarm him, but didn't. This is the end of part one of the podcast.